Hi, I'm Terry, and I'm an alcoholic. I was driving up from Richmond this afternoon, and I'm in the car thinking, gosh, you know, I really want to give some powerful words, and I wish I had this really great story to tell you all about, you know, DUIs and time in jail and all of that. And that is so alcoholic, because I want you all to be impressed, okay, and like me. So I want to tell you this good stuff. What you're going to hear is my story of alcoholism and how I found this fellowship. And it's really going to be a story about a person who really wanted to be liked and wanted to fit in. And alcohol was the way that I fit in and really lived. My sobriety date is March 5th, 2006. I became sober when I was 45 years old. I had a relationship with alcohol for 25 years until I got sober. At that, that relationship was really good for a long, long time. It worked for me. It helped me to achieve a lot of things. But it turned on me. And I used to be the master, and it became my master at the end. I was born in Northern Virginia. I have a home group. My home group is Into Action on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 7 o'clock. And Sam is part of our group in Richmond, and he invited me to speak today. So thank you, Sam. And it really is an honor to be here and a privilege. So thank you for being here. I grew up in Northern Virginia, grew into a family of middle class family, Northern Virginia, went to public high school. Really no experience of alcohol during high school except two incidences that I wanted to bring forward. I was a nerd, okay? I was just an outright nerd. I was on the debate team. I wanted to be popular. I wanted to be pretty. And I was on the debate team, okay? I was a nerd. I got straight A's, okay? And that's what I did. I excelled in school. And I so desperately wanted to be cool. And I remember there was a guy in my history class, and he was on the football team, and he would cheat off of me, okay? And that was the only thing I had to offer, was he could cheat off of me. But he offered to make me a fake ID, okay? If you guys remember back with the Virginia driver's license, when they had the green pieces that would go in the back of the driver's license, he made me my first fake ID, my only fake ID. And I was so excited. Went home. And remember, I'm a nerd. I'm a mama's girl, and I'm a nerd. I come home, and I tell my mother about my fake ID. Okay? Mom, look what I got. Okay? And so we went to 7-Eleven together. My mother sat in the car, and I went in to go and buy a six-pack of beer. Okay? I was so excited. I had arrived. I was 16 years old, okay? Went up there, put it up there, and the gentleman, the clerk, pulled out the license. I mean, pulled it out, looked at it, and then pulled up the fake one. My real one was right behind it, okay? And he goes, young lady, and I said, wait, just wait. Ran to the car, got my mother. Okay, she went in there, she bought the beer and stuff like that. Never used a fake ID again, okay? But that was, okay, to kind of show you my mindset, I wanted to fit in. I wanted to be cool. But I really didn't know how to, and I went right to my mother to help me, okay? Now, that was junior year, senior year. I am valedictorian in the class. I am high school vice president. I am Miss Goody Two-Shoes. And I wanted to bring alcohol to school because the cool kids alcohol in their lockers. So I went to my parents, can I bring some alcohol to school? Thinking that they would let me, you know, this is not normal thinking. And they said, well, Carrie, why don't you just drink at home with us, okay? And they drank. We had a family that drank, and said, but it's not the same. And so they kind of talked me out of that. But I remember thinking, if I had alcohol in my locker, I would be accepted, and I would be a cool kid. My grandfather was an alcoholic. Grew up, he ended up dying in his early 60s of something related to alcoholism. He had always been sick, and he was diabetic, and something had to do with his liver. So, but he would always, the family knew that he was the alcoholic in the family. And during the holidays, he would come, and he lived close by in Northern Virginia also. So he would come over and be drunk on the holidays, but he was a really nice, happy drunk, okay? He gave us money. It was, we all kind of knew, oh, his name, we called him Fafa. That's Fafa. You know, he's just drunk and everything. But alcoholism, I was aware that there was alcoholism in my family, and we didn't really talk about it. It was something you just kind of kept. That was the grandfather. He just didn't really talk about it. We never talked about it as a family in the open. So I go off to college, go to Charlottesville for school, and really nothing was out of the ordinary. I partied in college, did the normal things that college students do, but still got good grades and everything. So wasn't really an issue as far as drinking. You know, when I did drink, I tended to drink a lot. But I also drank a lot of water or soda. I just consume a lot. I do things in extremes and whatever I'm doing. And when I would drink, it would be usually to get, you know, you would get sick. I just assumed everyone drank till they got sick. Graduated from college. Really didn't know what I wanted to do, so went to law school. I mean, that just did okay. You know, I can do school. School's pretty good. School's controlled environments. And I could also, if I did well, I recognized people liked me. I got approval from my parents. I got approval from other people. When I excelled and when I did well, people paid attention to me, and that really felt good, okay? So went on to law school in Richmond, and then what started happening was you would study really hard during the week, and then the weekends you would start partying. It was a reward. Alcohol became a reward for me. I work really hard, and I can have the alcohol. And it kept me controlled. So I did that for 3 years and did fine in school. Went on, got a job with a big law firm. And it was the same type of controlled environment. If I work really hard, then alcohol is my reward. When I would get home, I deserve it. Okay? And I was functioning, no problems, you know, as far as I could see, there wasn't any problems. It was a reward. Work really, really hard, and then just drink on the weekends. And that was going okay. I was doing it and everything. But what was happening was I was no longer in school, so I didn't have a controlled environment, as much control as school had been. I wasn't getting the accolades for being a good student. I was now in a work environment. My ego really was going wild. At the same time, my inferiority complex. Okay, I wasn't. There would be parts of me saying, okay, I am so stupid, I can't handle this. I can't do the work in this law firm. Then the other side of me is like, oh, these people are so stupid, They don't know what's going on. It was this conflict inside of me between my ego and then feeling totally worthless. And that was always a conflict with me. How can I? I'm not worthy. I can't do this. Everyone else is smarter than me. Everyone else is prettier than me. Everyone else comes from the right family. And then the next side is my ego is just flaring up. So what ended up happening was about 2 years at the firm, I end up leaving because I'm like, I'm not connecting. I can't maintain relationships with people, with my coworkers or my boss. When I was in school, when it was all me, I could do it. But now I had to interact with everyone else, and I just didn't have the skills. And I had the ego and then the inferiority complex. So I left there. And then 3 more jobs later, I go from a big law firm. I go, oh, that's not what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm supposed to be in-house counsel. So I went in-house counsel with the corporation. Well, that wasn't any better. Then I went with a trust. You know, I just kind of went around trying to find the right fit for me. And now I can say it was me. I wasn't comfortable. I didn't know how to work in those environments. It was always my boss's fault. They didn't appreciate me. Big one. They didn't appreciate me enough. Or I just can't cut it. You know, those were all the thoughts that were going through my mind. So I am now job hopping. And, you know, luckily, it was easy to get jobs. So I didn't see it as really a negative because it was just, this is going on my career growth path. But I was just running from things, trying to find the right fit. And all the time, now drinking, and when I'm drinking, it's a lot of drinking. Going out with people from work, they're having to drive me home. There's becoming, you know, I'm one of the guys. I am drinking with the guys. And, you know, it's really not a cool thing for ladies to be drinking faster and more than your date that you go out with. I mean, that is not something that you really want to put down your resume as your claim to fame. And I could easily outdrink most of the guys. So this kind of is going on in my mid-20s. Now I'm like, okay, very gold person. I'm a gold-oriented person. I put my mind to something, and I achieve it. And that's how I have always functioned in my life. And now it's time to get married. Okay? It's in this kind of, I'm 25, 26, 27 years old, so it's time to get married. So I go and find someone who drinks just like I do. Okay? And now I am really happy, okay? Now I can get on because really it wasn't the job, you know. I wanted to be a lawyer, but that wasn't making me happy. I need to be a wife now. Okay? If I find the right guy and I now will start a family and I'll be happy. So I found the guy, got married, started having kids. He drank just like I did. I had a built-in drinking buddy. Okay? A couple years into that now. You know, this really isn't making me happy. You know, now my job's not making me happy. Being a mom's not really making me happy. These kids, they're a lot of work. And I am everything. I am discontent. There is nothing that is making me happy. I'm going to church, okay? I'm doing that because that's what you're supposed to be doing. I'm teaching Sunday school. That's not making, you know, everything is just not making me happy. I'm just, but what is making me happy?
is when I get that alcohol in me. At the end of the day, that alcohol comes in, and it's just like, it just kind of takes over my body, and it's good, okay? Life is pretty good then with the alcohol. Kind of life percolates along. No consequences that I am seeing. In hindsight, I can see a lot of the job switching and being discontent was all disease. But at the time, I don't see that at all. My former husband and I get the opportunity to go over to Hong Kong. So we live in Hong Kong for 4 years. And I think, oh, this is great. I'm not happy with what I'm doing now. Let's just bring the whole family over there and try life in Hong Kong. Well, life in Hong Kong gave me the flexibility and the freedom to drink. Now I'm not working. So my controls are less. Okay? I hook up with women who start drinking at lunchtime. And this is what everyone's doing. And very nice. I have live-in help. I don't have to be there for the kids. I can drink. I can go out with these women, and we can just drink all day. So the drinking started picking up more. Now I'm drinking during the daytime. So I limit. I really got to limit my drinking. I say, let me only drink on the weekends, Friday and Saturday. Well, you know, you need to start your weekend starting Thursday. You know, so it's now Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Oh, we have that thing on at the club on Sunday. So it became Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Okay, and I could justify that. And I did this for a few years. Okay, let me just do the weekends. And then come Monday, I am just holding on until the weekend gets here so that I can start drinking again. And then, because it's the weekend, I feel like I'm really entitled to it. It's just as much as you can get in you then. Because I know I've got to stop on Monday because I've had this, you know, this rule that I have to stop. Had an experience in Asia where we went out, big group of us went to a Mexican restaurant doing tequila shots in downtown Hong Kong in an industrial area of Hong Kong. And nice Mexican restaurant kind of stuck in this industrial area. I think we were doing limbo and everything with that. Tequila shot, excuse me. I go outside for some air. I can't find the doorway to get back inside the restaurant. Okay, I am so wasted that I go outside to get air, and then I get disoriented. And I start walking around. And this is bad part of Hong Kong, an industrial area. Me with my jewelry on, looking as foreign as can be in Hong Kong. And I'm just walking around, trying to get back into the restaurant with all my friends. I can't find it. Fear just grips me. I find a taxi. Call a taxi. I mean, just get the taxi, come over. And I am able to tell him my address. And then I pass out in the back seat of the car. No phone. No wallet. Nothing. No identification. No passport, nothing. And I just pass out on this back seat of this taxi. By the grace of God, I get home to my apartment. I have, to this day, I have no idea who paid the fare for me. And we had guards at our apartment building. And one of the guards took me out of the car and brought me up to my flat on the 10th floor and put me into my bed. And I never knew any of this. You know, everyone at the parties looking for me, they, you know, these are just, you don't do these types of things. This is not safe. And then I, the other occasion in Asia that was, and now these weren't every, you know, I didn't do this all the time, but when I did it, it was really big. My 39th birthday, really don't like birthdays. I don't do birthdays well. And so decided that I would just get a group of women together and meet at lunchtime and start drinking. So we started drinking. And this is very high end. This is classy stuff. I mean, we're drinking nice drinks, okay? And, you know, people who are classy don't have drinking problems, you know, in my mind, okay? Because, you know, we're drinking good stuff. So we drank all day, and then it was 6 o'clock, and my kids were going to take me for my birthday dinner. My kids now are 5 and 8. They take me to dinner with their father, and I sleep during dinner. Okay, my head is on the table at this restaurant with a family birthday. The cake comes. Okay, they have to wake me up for the birthday, and my kids are saying, "Daddy, what's wrong with Mommy? She's not feeling good. She's just not feeling well." Well, so this goes on. He's drinking. My husband's drinking like I am drinking also. And marriage is falling apart. We finally get back to the United States. And I am really sure that it's the marriage. That if I just got out of this marriage, I would be happier. And I get to the point that you can't, you know, where many of us have been, there's no end. How do you get out of something? I'm in a rotten marriage. I'm drinking all the only salvation I have is drinking. So don't ever take that away from me, because that's the only thing that's keeping me, you know, holding on. What do I do? Ultimately, get out of the marriage, thinking, okay, now things, this will be getting better. And during this time now, I'm beginning to think that I have some problems with alcohol, because my friends aren't having the consequences. They're not falling asleep at the table. They're not getting lost and can't get back into the restaurant after they go out for air. But I don't talk to anybody about this. I mean, this is something you don't ever talk about it. You know, inside I'm thinking, I have a problem. Maybe I have a problem. No, I really don't have a problem, because I can stop. And it's just that back and forth. So I start reading a lot of books. And I don't know if any of you all have. I went to the bookstore, bought all the books on alcoholism and how to master it, basically, okay? Because it's all about controlling it. If I want to control it, I can control it. So let me put my mind to this effort of figuring it out. And so I would start reading, and I would have these charts and mark the days I don't drink, okay? Well, then I would have, one drink, one glass of wine. And you know what a one glass of wine is, okay? You get the biggest glass of wine you can find and count that as one. So I was doing these types of things to manage it and to figure it out. I did share with one friend of mine during this time period that I thought I may have a drinking problem. And that took a lot of, I mean, really just to tell her. And then once it was out, I regretted it, because I never felt the same drinking around her, okay? It ruined the drinking in front of her.
But we never really, you know, she wasn't used to, you know, she wasn't an alcoholic. She wasn't in the recovery circle. So she didn't really quite know what to do with that. And that was probably 6 or 7 years before I ultimately got sober into the fellowship. So, now I have moved out. My kids are with me. My kids are 8 and 10 years old. I am now working. And there's no other adult in my house now. I'm no longer drinking socially. I'm not going out to nice brunches and drinking. My whole social life is just, it's not there anymore. I don't have any friends. I was in Asia for all these years, came back, marriage is falling apart. I don't have any friends. I have my kids, and I have my job. But I have alcohol. And the alcohol is really what was my friend. I would go pick up my kids from daycare, drive home. I'm not a big cook. And I would say, okay, guys, where do y'all want to go eat dinner? They would want McDonald's. I'm like, no, no McDonald's. They say, how about Friendly's, Mom? No, mm-mm. How about Applebee's? Okay? Because Applebee's, I can get wine. Okay? So we never ate out unless Mom could drink her wine. Okay? So that was kind of, you know, what was happening was it was me and the kids, and I would drink as soon as I would get them, and then bedtime, and then I would be drinking the rest of the night until I passed out. And I would call some people, but nothing, it was just me, just drinking, until I could start over the next day. I remember the time my daughter came back from second grade. It was like the first week of school when you're still buying a lot of school supplies. And we had gotten all the school supplies that they needed. She comes home, and I realized I didn't have any wine at home. And when I didn't have wine at home, I really got squirrely. I mean, how was I, because I couldn't go out once they had gone to sleep. I mean, that wouldn't be a good mom. So I needed to somehow get the wine there and have it. And this evening, I didn't have any wine. So I turned to Kendall, and she's 8. Don't you need some school supplies? She goes, no, I have everything. I said, no, don't you need something? She's like, uh-uh. I said, you need some crayons. Get in the car. Come on. And we went to the store and got crayons. Okay, the child did not need crayons. She didn't even want to be there because they didn't like going to the store. And there I was with my 3 jugs of wine and a package of crayons. Because, by gosh, we needed crayons, okay? And that was what was happening with my life, was everything was... I was holding it together, I thought, so well, because I was planning. You know, I was planning how to get my wine there, so that when the kids went to sleep, so I started drinking when they were awake, but then I could really kick in once they had gone to sleep. But everything became around, do I have enough wine? And during this time, I'm still thinking, ooh, maybe I need to cut back some. So... rather than buying the big jugs of wine, you remember, you know those little, they come in 4-packs, the little, cute little bottles of wine? Really expensive if you're going to drink lots of them, okay? But I thought, I won't open. If I can control it. If I'm only drinking one of those bottles, one, you know, I can come home and drink one, and that's okay. 1, 2, 3. I went through that 4-pack so quickly. And then I would go into the next one.
And I had such good intentions. That was what, you know, I didn't want to be doing this. You know, why do I start drinking and then I can't seem to stop it? I couldn't figure that out. And I went to a, since 8, 9, 11, around that age now, I go to a Tech UVA football game up here. Luckily, I never drove. I was fortunate and had other people always driving me, so that was a real blessing. Went up there, we lost, of course, and so, you know, I had never gone to a football game without being drunk. You know, you tailgate beforehand, then you have all your little bottles in your pockets, and then you drink there, and then you come back and you drink some more, because you have to wait for the traffic, because there's a lot of traffic between Charlottesville and Richmond after a game. So you're just sitting here drinking. And I get home, and my friends pour me into bed. Mind you, my kids are with me. This was a family outing that we all were going on. And we get home. I get poured into bed, and my friend, the kid's father had them that night, so my friend dropped them off at their father's house. And when I wake up the next morning, there's a note from my 10-year-old son beside my bed that said, "Mom, you disgust me." And that was it. That's all he said. And I remember looking over at that and reading that and feeling that disgust and shame, that why do I do this? You know, these are the two most important people in my life, are my children. And I disgust my son. That was sobering in that I felt really bad about it. But it didn't stop me from drinking. You know, I cleaned up my act for a week or so. Immediately apologized. "Oh, we'll never do that again. I'm so sorry." Well, my kids had heard this too many times. They were going through the trash can in the mornings to see how many bottles of wine I had gone through the night before. I started taking my trash outside so that my 8-year-old daughter would not call me on how much I was drinking. Things were beginning to get out of hand here. I'm isolating. I am just drinking, and I have the kids. And yet, to me, I have it all together. I have a job. I have a house. You know, I'm not having consequences, but I'm not able to control this anymore. Before this time period, when I came back from Asia, just to show you the length that I went to control my drinking, I said, "I can't drink if I'm exercising. If I am running, I can't drink too much the night before." So I signed up to run a marathon. And I trained for 6 months so that I wouldn't drink too much. And that was what I thought. That was the insanity of, I will control my drinking by doing a marathon. I ultimately did 10 marathons so that I wouldn't drink. Okay? That's crazy. But to me, that was a way of control, forcing myself to control my drinking. I start seeing a counselor, and I'm a real proponent of professionals. In my home group, we have
a very strong CBC committee of outreach to professionals. And I was going to a counselor, complaining about my family, my marriage, my children, my job, you name it, you know, all the typical things that you go and whine about. And I had been seeing him for a couple of years. And for some reason, I was honest with him about the drinking. I really was. And he said, well, try stop for 30 days. I tried, but I was going on vacation. I mean, you can't. Really, come on. You can't stop drinking when you go on vacation. It was just a bad, you know, 30 days. So let me find another 30 days. Well, that never worked. But I'm kind of going back, cycling back through him when I need a little pep talk and everything. Finally, he goes, Terry, I can't help you. I'm paying you. I can't help you. You have a drinking problem. Stop drinking and then come back. Well, I got very, you know, I thought that was pretty, I thought that was pretty shitty of him because, you know, you know, I have co-pays. But about 2 years before that, a year and a half before that time period, there was a woman in my church who I knew was in recovery. So I reached out to her, and we went for coffee, just like a good AA. You know, she met me at the Starbucks, and we talked, and she told me her story, and I listened. And I immediately said, not me, okay? She had consequences. Social services had been in her life. She drank and couldn't go to work. You know, she had a DUI. Those are the things I heard. I heard all the things that I didn't have yet. And I compared myself away. Thank you, but that's not me. And so that was a year and a half, 2 years. Now the counselor finally tells me, don't come back, Terry. You have a drinking problem. I walked out of that counselor's office, and I called that woman that I had met with a year and a half ago. And I said, I'm ready. It was just, I was done. I knew that. So I said, I'm done. I had just gotten to the point that I was doing things morally that wasn't my moral compass. I was messing up these two wonderful children that I had. It just wasn't working anymore. I had tried everything, and it wasn't working. And so I called my friend, and I said, okay, take me to an AA meeting. And that was on a Friday, and on a Saturday night then, we went to the meeting, and I picked up my white chip. You know, people ask, you know, why I didn't have, there wasn't, my last drink was the night before some wine. It wasn't even a really good drunk. I mean, if I had known now that that was going to be my last drunk, I would have done something fabulous so that I could go out and remember it. And it was so nondescript. But I think I was just finally ready. I couldn't fix it. I couldn't control it. My willpower could not make my life manageable. And, you know, it took me 25 years of drinking to finally realize I wasn't in control and I couldn't do this. So the first came in, first month was just, you know, horrible. I thought you guys sat in the back of the room. Didn't speak to anybody. I came in 5 minutes late, and I left as soon as it was over with. I didn't want to talk to a soul. I didn't want to be there, but I didn't know what else to do, so I was just there. I ate so much candy. I just remember always having candy with me. Because I never had a sweet tooth, because I had so much sugar from the alcohol.
And I just thought that life was going to be over with. Without alcohol, I thought my life was just, you know, I'm just going to click time off now until I die. You know, just, it's going to be just, at least I won't be drinking, you know. And it will be, you know, it'll be okay. I guess I'll smile again. Maybe I'll go on vacation again. And holidays, oh, how was I ever going to get through a holiday, Christmas, without mimosas? And that's what I thought the first, you know, the first couple months. And what was so wonderful was people said, you don't have to think about Christmas. It's March, Terry. Don't worry about Christmas. You know, what am I going to do about my daughter's wedding? She's 10. You don't have to worry about your daughter's wedding. And I'm like, okay, you know. But that was, those were the things that were really important to me. Okay, what happens when someone dies? No one's dying, so don't worry about it. And what people just said was just keep coming back. Don't think about it too much. Don't try to overanalyze all of this. I went to Aruba 22 days sober with my kids. We had a vacation planned. And I struggled. Do I keep this vacation or not? This is right maybe 9 months after Natalie Holloway thing. So I'm there in Aruba. My kids were at the little tiki bar. And I have to stay away. I mean, I can't even get near that bar because vacations always were about drinking. I went there with my big book. I had all this literature. That literature was like, it was like my armor. If I would just keep reading the literature over and over again, I would stay away from that bar. I got through it. I went to a meeting in Aruba. It made the place in Hong Kong seem mild. And someone picked me up for another meeting, you know. And I, in hindsight, you know, I was so naive and so, but I was holding on to this fellowship to get me through that vacation. And it got me through it. It really did. Life in the fellowship, I have had so much more fun and so much joy in my life now that I would never have imagined that. If I had known how good life would be, I would have joined this fellowship a long time ago. You know, it's, I don't need alcohol now. I don't even think about alcohol. It's living life now. Joyous, happy, and free. I've had one sponsor. I've been very fortunate. I've had the same woman since I came in the program. I have changed my home group from the original one. I'm still not a big sharer at meetings. I still have a hard time just sharing at meetings. But I am really into service. And I joined a home group that is very service-oriented. And I take a meeting to the jail with women. I go to Tucker's, which is our detox center. I take a meeting in there. We have IOPs that I'll go to. For my sobriety, I have to stay really connected to the program. And for me, I needed more than just meetings. And I know meetings are really important, but I had to do that service piece. I had to get out of my comfort zone and go into service. And making coffee just didn't cut it for me. That was good service in the beginning, but I needed to grow with it. And that's what I'm finding in the fellowship, is just something that you grow with. I had the opportunity to go to the international convention. And I saw Christine down there last summer. Those are experiences and opportunities that just help me grow in my own sobriety. My character defects, I mean, my ego is still there, my pride is still there, and I have to be close to the program on a daily basis to keep those in check. Because if I don't keep those in check, it will just go rampant. I mean, I'll never be cured. All I can try to do is live my life based on those principles of the 12 steps. Every night before I go to bed, I do a mnemonic called Safeguard. And I think, okay, Terry, Safeguard. And it's for, was I selfish today? Was I fearful? The S and the F. Was I resentful? And D, was I dishonest? And then the big G in the center of Safeguard is God. And so every night, I just go through that real quick for me, because I could never remember what I was supposed to do on that 10th step. And I hated having to be in bed going, what were those things again I'm supposed to be thinking about? And for me, it's Safeguard. And I know if I, every day, if I figure out where I am, selfish, resentful, fearful, or dishonest, it clears it away. And I can start over the next day. My family has never accepted that I was an AA. They're still active drinkers, and alcoholism is in their mind is a moral issue that I should have been able to just deal with. And this is almost 5 years in the program, and they just don't want to talk about it. You know, it's just, and I keep saying, oh, I'm going to an AA meeting. That's good for you. You know, and that it's just too close. And they don't want to deal with it. And that's okay. My dad came through Richmond this past summer and said, I have something for you. So we met for lunch. And he handed me, this is a second edition of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he handed it to me. He goes, this is for you. I don't think you need it now, but this is for you. And I'm like looking at this going, wow, Dad, Alcoholics Anonymous, how did you even know about this? And I opened it up, and it is dated March 9th, 1978. I graduated high school in June of 78. And it says, my dearest Terry, today 95% of both men and women consume alcohol in some form at least once a week by the time they are halfway through high school. Besides being my favorite granddaughter, you are a smart and sensible person. Remember this, when a drink becomes a necessity instead of an enjoyment, take up this book and read a chapter. Lovingly, Fafa. This was my grandfather. I had never seen this book. That was in 1978. I didn't come into the fellowship until 2006. And for me, what this was validation from my family. This was another alcoholic reaching out to another alcoholic, even from the grave, that I am doing the right thing. And the rest of my family won't accept or acknowledge, but here is a book from my grandfather since 1978. I mean, if that's not God, I mean, he saw something in me. You know, I had two brothers. They didn't get one. It's just me. So, thank you very much for letting me share, and I really, it's been great being here. So thank you.